Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. So that's just completely. I was thinking, wow, this music is so
great,
good,
isn't it?
Yeah. Where did you get it wrong?
So good.
Where did you go?
I was miles away, wasn't I? What's my name? Where am I? I've been here before somewhere. Is this like waking up from a dream? This is season 5, episode 7 of Cinematica. My name is. What is my name? Dan Slavin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio, we have the full team back together once again. Simon, you look fantastic in
those
sunglasses.
Simon Kennedy on asses.
That's me. Should be on a yacht in the Mediterranean. I should be like, browning myself next to scantily clad models from all over the world.
And your beautiful wife.
The paparazzi. Yes.
Yeah, my beautiful wife and 3 children.
And we have Simon back, and also we have Kaylee across the table.
Yes.
And how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm a little bit warm. I don't do well in humidity.
No, maybe that was why I zoned out for a little bit, because there's the rhythm of the rain on the roof, which is kind of hypnotic, and the humidity and the heat.
But you got to say this is perfect, because it's not...
Perfect cinema weather.
It is. It's wet and it's overcast, but it's not cold. It's just warm, and so you can go out and... wander about and then
and then go back to the movies for a second.
Yeah, Saturday was so hot for me that I was just, I'm going to the cinema today.
I can't believe it.
Too hot.
When I was a kid, you didn't get summer like that this early. You didn't.
No, well, yesterday did not feel like summer to me. Yesterday, I got up, left the house thinking that it would be like the weekend, only rainy, and then froze my bits off. It was so cold.
Your junk.
So cold. Basically anything that was hanging off me was freezing yesterday.
That's too much. That's too far. We're going to have a warning at the front of this episode.
Look, I tell you. Okay, well, we shall diverge onto... I'll tell you something that I did on my weekend. I went to Auckland for the weekend, most specifically to watch Mandy Patinkin sing at the Aotea Centre with an American opera singer called Nathan Gunn. And Mandy Patinkin, I don't know if you are familiar with his singing as well as his acting, but he is the bomb. He's just so good. And it was a super relaxed, super laid-back show. And he also, without any prompting from the audience, and got a standing ovation in the middle of the show simply for saying, "My name is Inigo Montoya." "You killed my father. Prepare to die. And it took him like about a minute and a half to do it, because he really stretched it out, to really milked it. But he knew what a lot of people had been there for. And so fantastic. That was the sort of movie related part of the show. The rest of it was all Broadway and show tunes. And he performed all of Bohemian Rhapsody by himself, doing all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty good. That was my weekend. What did you get up to? Did you go to the movies? Did you go out? Did you play sport?
I did a lot of good things. I went to the movies. I went to the Doctor Who Cinematic Spectacular. It's pretty good.
Yes. So now that it's playing, it seems to be playing often in cinemas. Should we start considering it to be a cinema event?
Well, I thought about that.
Did it feel cinematic? Did it feel like you were watching a really big TV?
But is it going to be on telly?
Already been on TV.
It was already on television. They couldn't screen it in the cinema until it had screened on television. And there was like a global synced television
debut. But it was like breakfast here on Sunday morning, wasn't it? For the television screening. So actually, for a lot of people going to the movies on a Sunday afternoon was... So did it feel...
Was it scary?
I wouldn't say it was scary.
I remember hiding behind my couch when I was about 5 watching Doctor Who.
I don't know if it does it for people quite the same degree. It's more soap opera now, isn't it?
No.
Yes, it is.
No. Not really.
See, I have the
bus track.
It's like soft core sci-fi. Right. You know, there's a lot of human drama.
But that's soap. Yeah. soap
yeah.
opera.
Yeah. Well, when I think of soap opera, I think of like really, really bad drama. Like,
right. See, when I think of soap opera, I just think of recurring characters going like just going on and on and on and on and on. And that's pretty much what this one does. Mm. So you can tell that the 21st century Doctor Who has not crossed over into my world, really. So many of my friends on social media, it's all Doctor Who squee, Doctor Who, you know, and I just don't get it at all.
Make a movie and then we'll be interested.
Mm. Yeah, but maybe this is what it is. Maybe these big screen things are movies.
How long was this thing?
An hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I decided while watching it that it wouldn't. I mean, it's. Yes, watching television in cinema is made for cinema. It was in 3D, but it can't stand alone without you knowing the rest of the universe of it. So that way, I don't know if it really counts as a movie, but
that's a very interesting argument about what makes something cinematic. Does it stand alone? We're about to be talking about a film called The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, which I wonder if somebody just walking in off the street watching it without having seen the one before, without knowing the world that we're in, to what extent they would it would appeal to them. So perhaps we'll come back to that discussion, because I'm really interested in what makes something cinematic as opposed to televisual. It used to be there was a kind of aesthetic about it. It used to be that TV, stuff that was made for TV, first of all, looked cheaper. Second, which now doesn't happen so much because of digital effects. Also, there will be a lot more close-ups, a lot more faces on television, a lot less landscape, because you needed to be able to see faces on a really small screen. But now I just think the crossover's getting kind of weird. Really.
Thanks to widescreen television.
So that, perhaps people could get in touch with us and let us know what they think. What makes something cinematic to them? You know, like a documentary or a motion picture film, feature film. Talking of getting in touch with us, you have access to the mailbox.
I do, also known as our Twitter feed. Woo! Mr. Stephen Moore says, "Damn you, Cinematicast! Now I have Cliff's Carrie stuck in my head. # earworm. # damn you all to hell."
Yeah, I think the title of last week's
tweet of the week.
damn you all to hell.
The title of last week's show will have had particular resonance for people of about my age. Si, you weren't here. Carrie. We talked about Carrie.
Oh, the film.
Yeah.
And it was a scary film, eh?
Not
the new one. I'm not suggesting that for a minute.
No. But the title of last week's show was a reference to the Cliff Richard song called Carrie, which...
Carrie doesn't...
There we go. Done it again for you, Stevie. Anymore. I knew it.
Carrie!
Yeah.
Was it the seventh or second floor?
Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember which floor she was on.
Okay, so what else have people been telling us?
Scary!
Reese Pie submitted their two-word review for Like Father, Like Son, classic Koreeda, such a wonderful director, and then you just rained on that parade.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, well,
remake.
That's right. Like Father, Like Son played in the New Zealand Film Festival, and I think is getting a release elsewhere around the world, but I don't know if it's on any schedules to come back here. But it was a big hit at Cannes, where Steven Spielberg was the president of the jury, and he's already, you know, got the rights to remake it for Western audiences.
And my favorite two-word review of the week from Mark Rolston is for Hunger Games: Catching Fire, J-Law and Disorder.
And we've just had word from our resident expert that Like Father, Like Son is down for the New Zealand on the release schedule.
There's a screener.
Rialto Distribution.
Yeah, Rialto.
Own it?
There's a screener.
Yeah.
They're asking the question.
Oh, is that right? Oh, okay, so so perhaps new audience members, listeners, if you saw it at the festival, do you think it should come back? Perhaps you could get in touch with Rialto Distribution and start
harassing them.
They're going to love that. They're going to love you.
Look,
should we give them an email address? Or a phone number?
Look, I just think that, you know, you don't know. If you don't ask, you don't get, basically. And
it's very true.
And you know, so many distributors now are actually, they're just testing the water with these things. And, you know, they don't know necessarily how well something's going to do, because nobody does.
That's true.
Speaking of not knowing things, I had an interesting debate with someone about movie posters. And I think that really, before you let someone design a movie poster, you should let them watch the film. Because there's some movie posters out right now that do not convey the film at all. I won't name names, but free advice.
But Kelly, that's marketing.
Yeah.
They're over there.
It's not about the film as it exists. It's marketing. About the idea of
and
the film.
And we just hand it over to marketing. And they know they're tapped in.
And the films aren't finished.
Because they're listening to all the social media bubble all the time, tapped into that. And they know they just have a sense. And it's targeted at a certain demographic and sex. And so the poster will be skewed that way.
And comedy films have to be white posters with red type.
Yes, they do. Mm.
Yeah. And if they're from Britain, they have a British flag on them.
Right. Yeah, that's
Or
that's
a British gem, they often quite often say.
Yeah. The word gem.
And if they've got an ensemble cast, then you need three different photographs, like a group photo, and you need to split the postage. So there are rules that I'm sure that's one
otherwise
of the things.
Otherwise, it'd be anarchy.
Sure that's one of the things they're arguing about at the Trans-Pacific Partnership at this very moment is like establishing rules across the entire world for how posters should look.
Mm.
Which one were you reading?
Yeah, go on.
Well, there's two. I found another one on the internet today.
Yeah.
The poster for One Chance in America is horrible. It's just James Corden's face, and it makes him look really fat. And basically, there's this tagline that talks about how he's fat.
So it doesn't mention the singing. So there's no, like, you wouldn't have an idea that actually he was an opera singer or anything like that.
No,
okay.
It's just his face with a red
background. That's somewhat misleading, yes.
Yeah. But it'll be worked out scientifically that probably a lot of fat people will want to go and see it because of the fat face. I guarantee you. There'll be science in it.
Okay, marketing graduates listening to the show, give us some ideas about how this is supposed to work. I know that it's all about, you know, you want to eliminate the things that people might not want. See, this is an interesting one because I watched the trailer for Philomena the other night for the first time, right? And you've seen the film. I haven't seen it. But so working off the trailer alone, I would think that it was a Steve Coogan comedy because the trailer punches up the usual Steve Coogan-ness of it. Like, it could be, it's like a slightly more serious Partridge is what the way that the trailer plays.
And that's what the poster looks like.
Right, but that's not the film, is it?
Mm.
Okay,
mm.
So yeah. Mm.
No, but if you want to get it into the multiplexes, that's what you do. Sorry.
That's so depressing. I've got zoned off again. Into
I know. Yeah, no, but that's what you do.
Mm. I love this. He's storing his sunglasses, listeners. He's Mr. Rock and Roll, or rather Mr. Greek Pop.
I should be, remember, what's his name? Off WKRP in Cincinnati.
Johnny Fever.
Johnny Fever.
Dr. Johnny Fever.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't have seen that, would you, Kelly?
No.
It's a brilliant show.
It was a brilliant show. In fact, it inspired...
If you ever wondered.
It inspired a complete life change for me, watching that. I literally went into radio because I wanted to be like WKRP in Cincinnati. Anyway, what have people been watching this weekend? We had a little bit of a chat about this beforehand, and I don't think there will be any surprises at number one, but maybe five to two, there might be some surprises.
Mm-hmm.
What have people been going to see?
In at number five, down from two, Jackass Bad Grandpa.
Yeah, I can't see that one having too much in the way of legs, to be honest.
No. One Chance is sitting at four for the second week.
There's some speculation that the One Chance might have actually picked up a bit from word of mouth.
Well, I don't know. There may be some locations that are trimming their sessions too.
Oh, okay.
So
you're reaping the rewards of that?
Possibly. Yeah.
It's picked up an additional screen this week.
Yeah, okay.
Mm. Thor, The Dark World is in three, down from one. In at number two, Doctor Who, The Day of the Doctor.
Oh, stop it.
That's a good effort, isn't it?
Wow, wow, wow. And at number one, The Hunger Games.
I think they're going to have a separate category for this, again, this argument about, you know, because it skews the figures. Wasn't it only one day?
Yep.
It was really only that Sunday, wasn't it?
No, it was more than one day, wasn't it?
Oh, it was
like 4 days.
It's the 4-day weekend, but I'm sure that the Doctor Who was only one of those 4 days.
I don't know.
It was on Sunday and then Monday, so if this includes Monday, it'll be in there as well.
Yeah. I don't know if it does.
So how much money have the BBC made off that?
This week, 1,800... Nope.
That's your average.
I don't know how to read numbers right now. $187,029.
That's not
at 20 locations on 20 screens.
that's a pretty good screen average as well. So I would say that that's a very successful experiment on the part of those guys. I wonder what other television there is that would have that same cut across.
Sex and the City, the reunion.
I can see where you're going with that. Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting though that when all of this digital transition was being first mooted, a lot of the sales points for cinemas was you'll be able to have other events that aren't just cinemas on your screen. And sport was one of the big sales pitches for this. You know, the people would be able to watch the All Blacks on the big screen with wine and food and what have you. And the sport side of things has just never panned out at all, has it? Like, you know, even that 3D that effort to sell 3D tickets to the Rugby World Cup, just they lost their shirts, those people. Mm. So I just think it's fascinating that people had an idea about how this was going to be. Rock concerts, live simulcast rock concerts and live sporting events, and actually what's really taken off is the NT Lives and the Met Operas and the high culture and hip television like Doctor Who. I just think that it's gone in a direction that nobody could have picked.
I think the sport side of it is still, there's still barriers pricing wise, you know, for cinemas to access it. So that's a barrier. You know, that's a big reason why that maybe hasn't taken.
But also, I mean, do audiences want it? Do audiences want to go to a cinema to watch watch an All Black game? Oh, there's a Football World Cup next year in Brazil, and I'm wondering whether because the timings of those games are going to be pretty awful for New Zealand audiences, so it'll be interesting to know whether cinemas open up at breakfast to do sort of a delayed football screenings. But, you know, with no New Zealand there, I wonder whether that's going to have an impact. But, you know,
if there's a buffet breakfast, I would be there.
You know, but the thing is to just roll out of bed and kind of just go downstairs or something and flop in front of the telly is quite, you know,
so yeah,
quite attractive, isn't it?
But you could say the same about Doctor Who, and yet that got people out of there.
Yeah, but that's the geek thing, isn't it? That's the whole event kind of geek, you know, party that I mean, not geek in a bad way, but just that's, you know.
And it was also 2D versus 3D.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So 3D was only available on the big screen. Mm. Yeah. Well, look, it's interesting. And if you've got any opinions, listeners, about this and theories, because I'm just like flying kites at the moment, I don't really know why it's panned out the way it has. But if you've got any ideas, we'd love to hear them, because it's changing the face of cinema and changing the marketplace big time. Time to talk about the number one film in New Zealand at the moment, and we will tell you whether it is worth your time. He said, having to remember to turn the fader up.
She's not who they think she is, and she has to be eliminated.
I agree, but in the right way, at the right time.
We have to go before they kill us. They will kill us.
People want to fight. I'm staying here.
They fought very hard in the games, Miss Everdeen. But they were games. Would you like to be in a real war? Imagine thousands of your people dead. Your loved ones gone.
What do I need to do?
All right, what does she need to do? Kaylee, you are going to look after this one for us. You're going to tell us basically what it's all about. Hunger Games.
Yes, so this is the second installment of the Hunger Games series, a trilogy of books, but a four films, a quadrilogy of films, because they are going to split the
quadrilogy is Latin for license to print money.
Yes. They, of course, are splitting the final book into two sections, which I think is a good idea. There's a lot that happens. But anyway, in this one, Katniss Everdeen and Peter Mellark return from the Hunger Games after surviving as a duo for the first time in a very long time that this has happened. And Katniss Everdeen has become the image of the rebellion that they're leading against Panem, which is this overseeing government of all the districts. And so because they've come back from the Hunger Games, they have to go on a tour to celebrate their achievements, but all hell starts to break loose. And the leader of Panem is not impressed, and he decides that all of the victors across all of the years are a threat, and so he sends them all back into the ring together to kill each other off.
That's basically it, isn't it? And there's some interesting sort of subtext going on in terms of the Hunger Games were originally invented as a sort of distraction to keep people to distract people from the miseries of their own existences, and you know, not a million miles away from reality TV
or the Roman arena, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Sort of cross between the two, but now it's not even working as a distraction anymore. He has to eliminate these people and start again from scratch and try and get a more compliant bunch of people in their place, because nobody's following the script that he's outlined for them.
No, and I mean, in it goes into much more detail in the book, obviously, and there is a lot going on where the outlying districts are all the ones who they create things, and they all get sent in the capital. So everyone in the capital is quite rich and well off and lives these cushy lives where everyone...
Indulgence.
Yes, and they love the Hunger Games because that's just entertainment for them. But the people in the districts, they're losing their sons and daughters and friends, and they're dying in these horrible games. It's quite tragic. The whole story. There's also the sort of pull for Katniss between, does she go with Peeta, who she's supposed to pretend to love because that's sort of how they survived, because everyone loved their love story, or does she actually stick with Thor's brother, who's super handsome and they've grown up together, and that's, you know, part of the drama as well.
Mm. But that's all handled, I think, really, really effectively, you know? And to be honest, much better in this second film than in the first. Now, I was watching it last night thinking, I'm, you know, really enjoying this much more than I did the first one, but I don't know to what extent that I was enjoying it because of the seeds that were sown in the first film. That the first film may not have won me over, but it did a job of setting the world up for me, so I didn't need, you know, it's very hard to create worlds and still have a kind of narrative drive. So maybe the first one failed a little bit in that sense, and the second one gets to reap the rewards of all of that work. Having said that, I think that also Jennifer Lawrence is just getting better and better and better in every film that she does, and she does just a fantastic job of action hero, romantic lead, troubled teen. You know, like all of those things wrestling inside of her are on display, and I think it's just a fantastic performance. And the young guy who plays Peeta, Josh Hutcherson, who has been frankly a bit average through most of his career, I thought it was the best thing that he's done as well. I thought that he had some really nice moments in the film last night. So yeah, I mean, everybody's good, everybody's raised their game, and of course they brought in Philip Seymour Hoffman, like proper actor, to add a whole lot of gravitas to the danger. He's the games master, who's setting up the Hunger Games and giving them the tests that they have to sort of overcome. Mm-hmm. They don't have to overcome just each other, the other competitors, but of course, you know, the environment that is being created for them as well.
Yeah, the film is one of the longer ones that's out at the moment. It seems to be a trend. We get those 2.5 hour films at the moment, but it does squeeze a lot in. There's a lot more in the book that happens, obviously, being like 500 pages or something. But I thought they translated it quite well and got quite a lot in. I know some people who didn't like it as much. They thought it wasn't as good because there wasn't as much action, because there is a lot of story building before
that. It takes a while to get to the games.
It takes a while to get to the games. But
and also there's a lot of sitting around talking in the actual arena itself. You know, it isn't just all sort of fight. And there's not a huge amount of even hand-to-hand combat in that world. There's a lot of sort of plotting and scheming and what have you going on. So that, yeah, I can understand how that might be a little disappointing for people. I went with a very excitable 10-year-old who had read the books and got a big kick out of the film last night, actually. And, you know, we went to the embassy in town, which he doesn't often get to go to, and it was a big occasion, big audience.
Did you go see an Atmos?
Yeah, and I tell you what, Atmos is just fantastic for this particular film, because once you get to the arena, it's it's set in 12, there's like 12 sectors, 12 segments, and it's like a clock face. And quite often sounds will travel all the way around you in the theatre as if you're in the centre of that clock face. It's just the sound design is fantastic, and what people are doing now with Atmos is really sort of raising the game. And I think it's the first time I've seen an Atmos film that wasn't also 3D, where the sound had to sort of do all of the world building, and I thought that was really effective too. So yeah, fantastic. So definitely, if you've got sort of a kid who's read the books and knows what's going on and is into that world, the film won't disappoint them at all, I don't think. My only disappointment with the film was the ending. I left kind of flat?
Well, I because I've read the books and they're still quite fresh in my mind, even though I read them quite a while ago, when the scene started, I sort of knew it was going to end, but it was a little bit like over dramatic and soapy the way it ended. I think they ended it in a good place. Because a lot of that, the next chapter is going to be built in the next. There's a lot of stuff. I don't want to spoil.
I'm careful to tread warily through this, but you know, the final two scenes of the film are basically people talking about things that have happened off screen, right? Instead of us being shown them. And so I actually felt as an audience that like we'd had a big tense climactic sort of exciting scene, and then the final two scenes in the film, all that tension sort of dissipates. It just felt like narratively a letdown. So obviously setting up a third film, obviously doing a job of delivering on expectations to people who'd read the book, but it just felt like there must have been a way visually to convey the information that what we got was people saying, oh, and this is what happened while you were asleep, basically. Yeah. And, you know, I just, that was a real disappointment because so much of the rest of the film had done the storytelling right, had shown a world instead of us being told about it. I wanted to go out feeling, but punching the air going, yeah, really enjoyed it. And instead it was like, Yeah.
I felt just kind of new, but because I've read the books, I was really excited. And I know what's coming, and so I'm excited.
How long do we have to wait?
I'm not sure. I'm guessing it's going to be another year.
I think is it going to be a little bit hobbity in that they'll end up with two in the final year or something like that, or you know where they were going to do a June and a Christmas or I don't know. Anybody got any idea?
I think there's only one more, isn't there?
There is only one more, but there's two more. There's two more Hunger Games. Yeah, yeah, so I'm not sure whether it's going to be a mid-year and a Christmas.
Yeah, I think
because that was the Potter did the same thing, didn't it? We ended up with two Potters in that last year.
Yeah.
Look, has anyone got the release schedule? Maybe I could.
I hope it's the same year, because it would kind of be annoying to have to wait. But who knows?
Look, I'm going to look it up on my calendar.
Right. Thing. So while you're looking that up, I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed it, although I am a fan of the books. I think it's a good movie to go to with the family, because I think a lot of people will get different things out of it. Mixed reviews aside, I'm giving it 2 thumbs up. I really enjoyed it.
Right. Well, the Mockingjay Part 1 is down for November 14. So 20th of November 14. So a year, and I would guess that means Part 2, Mockingjay Part 2, a year after that, 2015. It's a long time, isn't it, to wait to get to a conclusion that you pretty much know what's going to happen, don't you? You know what's going to happen at the end. Although the way it's getting to that that end point is surprising me more than I thought it would, and that's actually my 2-word review for the film is pleasantly unpredictable, because the actual path that they're taking and the choices that are being made along the way, I'm sitting there going, I don't actually know what's going to happen next, particularly when you get into the arena and you just you've got all of those people fighting each other and allegiance is being made, and you just don't know who's going to go
turn around and stab you in the back.
Yeah, well, who's going to go in what order, you know? Mm. And so on that basis, yeah, it's pleasantly unpredictable. And do you have two words for it?
I do have two words. My two words for Hunger Games Catching Fire are fire starter. And shout out to Weta for their one scene that they did the animation on. It looked fantastic.
Which one was it?
What is Weta great at? Monkeys.
Oh, you know what? I totally believed those monkeys. I thought, no good. They are the monkey experts, definitely. fairly terrifying that pack were. All right. Listeners of a certain age, of a Hunger Games-y sort of age, who have been tempted to find out what we think about that, if you're under 18, I suggest that you turn off or you ask your parents to come into the room and explain what we're going to be talking about next, because the next film we're going to talk about is called Filth.
Scotland was such a uniquely successful race. This nation brought the world television, whiskey, and of course, me, Detective Sergeant Bruce Robertson. The games are always being played.
That's everything you need to know about the gangs you're after.
I never thought I'd see the day when I left a knocking shop with more spunk than I came in with.
Filth is adapted from a novel by Irvine Welsh, who is best known for Trainspotting, and we hope the sequel to Trainspotting Porno, which is due... Well, there is an expectation that it will arrive at some point in the next 3 to 5 years. Filth is what we've got to go on in the meantime. Simon, this is one you have seen for us, and here you are. You're in your rock and roll sunglasses, and it seems to me that you're getting into the vibe of this, right?
I don't know. Maybe it's because I feel like I've got this amazing hangover from watching it, and I just need to dull my rest my eyes.
Yeah,
I think that might be more closer to the truth.
Right. Well, now you saw this a wee while ago.
Mm.
Did some of those images get seared enough into your brain that you can recall them?
Yeah. They haven't left me. There's some pretty. I've got to say, I went into it with a lot of hope and excitement about this film because of the background with Trainspotting and also James McAvoy, who I like to watch, and he's always, he seems to offer a lot.
Mr. Tumnus Goes Bad.
Yeah, it was like Mr. Tumnus Goes Bad, all right. And it just follows the life and times of this detective who's on the prowl for a promotion and is also just doing everything in excess, everything, and it's a wild kind of ride, really. But it's one that you kind of come out of feeling like a bit grimy and not that satisfied. I guess everyone will do it as they compare it to Trainspotting. And the thing about Trainspotting for me was that it was dark, it was nasty, but it had a charm and a wit to it and a humour. Whereas this is just kind of just bombards you with all of these things, and there's not really anything that is that clever or funny, and I think you need that in these types of films. Otherwise, you just come out of them feeling like you've gone through the ringer, and that's what I felt like when I came out of this film. I just felt like, gee, really, why, and just feeling a bit sort of shattered from it.
Yeah, it's not particularly clever, and it's not particularly funny. And I think that the distributor of this film have, unfortunately, they've drawn there's been a bit of bad luck, basically, because this is in this week of news in New Zealand, there's been the story about the rogue Christchurch cop with the sexual predator, and he was sentenced last week, and then we found out that he was doing this for years before anybody sort of twigged and actually sort of hauled him up for this. And and lots of lives seriously damaged by this real life individual. And so I was sitting there watching the film last night thinking, is this really, there's a time when this could be humorous, and then there's a time when it isn't, and this isn't one of those times when it isn't, unfortunately. And it didn't help that the film doesn't really know whether it's kind of celebrating the excess or condemning the excess.
Yeah,
it's sort of it's like it's having as much fun as he is, but without the sort of without a kind of moral core. Compass. Yeah, without a moral compass of its own to then say, you know what, this is wrong. It's like taking too much delight
and making you want to care for the characters.
Yeah,
you know. That's really important. If you can care for them, like you did with the characters in Trainspotting, you actually cared for them, even though they were doing crazy stuff to themselves. It was an awful descent into hell. You really cared for them, and you wanted them to sort of come out of it and survive and whatever. You were rooting for them in a way. Whereas this guy here, you don't care for him. He's just this all of this upfront kind of in your face, and it's just too much. That
and even
all the
when
time.
You and even when the film sort of offers you a little bit of, I guess, Christmas cracker psychology about how he's turned out to the way he has, none of that, you know,
it's too little too late.
It's too little too late and too kind of obvious as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, not a very sophisticated reading. What did you think of Mr. Tumnus himself? Like McAvoy? Did you? I just thought that all he really proved to me was that he can cry on camera.
I thought he just sort of carried off this manic. I mean, it was pretty one-dimensional. It was just pretty much the same thing, you know, off a lot, except near to the end where it does kind of change tack a little bit. But it's, I can watch him. I don't mind so much. But I think that he didn't have, you know, the question for me is, what did he have to work with? I'm not sure if it was him or if it was the material that he had.
Yeah, I don't think it's a particularly good script, and I don't think it's very well directed either. Mm. There seems to be a real absence of taste. And you can usually tell from a film from the music selections, you know, whether somebody's thinking particularly deeply or they, you know, and all of the music in the film was the most obvious, the kind of music that a TV commercials director would use. So, you know, there's a whole sequence where they obviously couldn't afford Radiohead's Creep, so they got a kind of sound-alike version of Creep. And you're thinking, well, that's all the lyrics in that song are telling you what we already know and what we can already see. And there were a lot of times, you know, Born to be Wild. I'm so sick of hearing Born to be Wild used in films as a kind of shortcut to explain what's going on. When you know, if you're half awake, you can work it out, right?
Yeah, 'cause I think you're absolutely right. 'Cause I mean, if I think in the hands of a different director and maybe with a different script, you know, it would have been something quite spectacular with the same cast. So I don't fault that in any way. I just think that they didn't have the material and they didn't have the right direction for this. And so it just felt very samey after a while. Yeah. And I was disappointed.
20 odd years ago, maybe even longer, I remember watching and being absolutely blown away by Harvey Keitel in Bad Lieutenant,
yeah,
right, which follows a very similar sort of path from an incredible film, and part of the reason why it was so much better a film was because all of his pain, all of his acting up, came out of pain that you could see etched in his face from the very beginning, and it was a deep moral, spiritual absence, you know, that was at his core. And there's this amazing scene in Bad Lieutenant where he ends up in church, basically just like throwing himself on the mercy of Christ on the cross, you know. And it's like that there's something like this deep psychological torment that he was experiencing. And it was, you know, the filth seems to be about somebody's ambition, you know, like you get an understanding of later in the film about why he's ambitious, but it just seemed like that there was a moral center absent.
And it's not sure what it is it?
That's right.
I mean, it flicks around a bit, and then it doesn't really have a clear path like something like Bad Lieutenant, where it's very clear. And that's the problem, I think, with the film. It's a shame. So, I mean, I haven't read the book, but the people who read the book sort of, you know, speak very highly of it.
Well, he writes really well. Yeah, Welsh writes really well. And there are maybe glimmers of it, but it relies way too much on the excesses and not enough on the sort of core, sort of moral core of the story. Two words, do you think you can come up with two?
I just said lacking charm.
I think that you'd be absolutely right there. Mine are, I'm not sure, I'm going to hyphenate cereal packet here, cereal packet psychology, and that'll be my two. Hey, Kaylee, did you see Filth?
No, it did not. Oh, right.
You just looked at me as a moment. Like,
I mean, Trance as well, I'd
say. Let the girl speak.
Well, but Trance, yeah, is better than, way better than
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And it had its flaws, but it's a much better film.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think it's a just a big disappointment. But time for some news now.
The race to the Oscars is really starting to heat up with the Hollywood Reporter's well-known... What's not the Hollywood Reporter?
Well, because the Hollywood Reporter's doing them as well. So
The
Hollywood Reporter does the roundtable interviews, and the New York Times, which is what you're thinking of, does the neat little short films.
Right.
We should put these links in the show notes, actually, so that people can understand what we're talking about.
Okay, so let's just rewind that and let me start again. The race to the Oscars is really starting to heat up with the Hollywood Reporter's well-known group video interviews with directors, actors, and actresses starting to appear every week. Another sign that we'll be talking about nothing but awards for the next 3 months are the Independent Spirit Awards nominations, which were announced this morning. 12 Years a Slave leads with 7 nominations. Also in the Best Picture category are All Is Lost, Frances Ha, Inside Llewellyn Davis, and Nebraska. I was confused the videos I watched today from the New York Times. Yes, which they take way too early, but they have these Oscar potential... best
well, this
performance.
Is the, yeah, this is the thing. Is there's going to be, you know, the nominations don't come out until the new year, right? So some of these people who are being touted and being interviewed by all of the magazines and getting magazine covers as being sort of Oscar contenders, some of these people are going to be a little bit disappointed through no fault of their own. You know, it's, I know that studios do campaigns and what have you, but still, it just all seems, it's like, you know, Christmas, there should be a law that says you can't even mention the word Christmas. No Snoopy, no tinsel, no Santa, no parades, any of it until at least December. 1st of December, go for your life. But before that, can we have a break, please? But no, the Santa parade in Auckland on last Sunday.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's mental. You know, it's going to be Christmas all year round pretty soon, you know. And I just think if they can pass a law that says you can't buy fireworks, you know, more than 3 days before November.
Isn't that the last one?
That we'll be able to buy fireworks?
Mm.
Or the last Santa parade? Either or.
I think it
was the last one you could buy fireworks, but I could be wrong about that. I think maybe it's next year, but there's a countdown, and then it's just, and then it's just exhibition stuff.
If Parliament can take the time to pass that law, I totally agree. Then let's do the same thing for Christmas, please, and the same thing for the Oscars. Frankly, we shouldn't let's not talk about the Oscars and awards contention. I mean, it happens at Cannes. You know, people are, you know, back in March, people are already talking about the Oscars for 11 months later. It's madness, and it has to stop.
Yeah, can I just say, Jean-Claude Van Damme should do a movie called The Last Santa Parade. Can I just say?
Yeah. Free ideas, yeah. Hollywood.
And there could be a Santa Parade. He'll be like standing between two balloons, and then he'll do a split.
Helium balloons, floating down.
Somebody really has to do
something with the Auckland, with that giant Auckland Santa on Wickles. Have you seen that?
No.
Have you seen the giant? It's going to be a bit hard to explain to listeners at home, but this year it's not quite as creepy as it has been in previous years, because in previous years it had a finger finger that moved,
beckoned you in,
and it was winking at you. It was the size of Wickles on Queen Street. So this year it's not quite as creepy, but he's still, you know.
Did you rush in and buy a book?
No.
Huh.
On self defense. Talking of award ceremonies and not Christmas, Christmas for New Zealand filmmakers. New Zealand's MOA, now known as the Rialto Channel New Zealand Film Awards, announced their nominations last week. The 5 best film nominees are The Weight of Elephants, Shopping, Mount Zion, Mr. Pip, and Out of Left Field, Fantail, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Loved it. White Lies didn't get a best film nomination, but did get nods for...
Fidemako.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I was going to look that up. Okay. Fidemako Black and Antonia Priebel. I thought her name was different for some reason. In the acting categories.
Pip.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be tough. What really pleased me,
Pip.
Yeah, I don't know. Mount Zion. Lots of people really like Mount Zion. And Weight of Elephants, of course, from in the art house category. But what I loved about that list was the fact that apart from The Weight of Elephants, we've interviewed all of the people behind those films, and I think it's a really good sign that Cinematica, the New Zealand film, from a New Zealand filmmaker point of view, you know, people love coming to talk to us.
We should present an award, Cinematica Award.
Well, I tell you what, if you have a word with Ant Timpson, he'll tell you how much that's going to cost you to sponsor. Yeah. Kay. So maybe not.
Ridiculous.
This is how these events
should sponsor it, and then we just put our name on it.
Or we'd have a whip round. We'd have a pledge. Listeners, should we sponsor an award at the New Zealand Film Awards? And we might need your help.
Everyone, just give us lots of money.
Yeah.
The best documentary category will be hotly contended as Gardening with Soul goes up against the likes of Antarctica, A Year on Ice, and Hitokahuna, New Zealand in Afghanistan.
It's gardening. I think it's a really good. Have you seen the Antarctica film? Yeah. Well, you then shut up. Because
no, I will not. Gardening, mate. Gardening.
Well, seriously, I love it when people I know what's going to win. Boom, and they haven't seen the rest of the film.
I don't care. I'm just such a passionate gardening fan, and I tell you what. I mean, you've got to wink. You've got to. It's not all about that, but you've got to give a wink to box office, don't you? You've got to give a nudge to it.
Yeah, you have to acknowledge it. I don't.
It's not the be all end all. I agree, but it does have a weight.
But you really should. You really should watch, if you get a chance, watch the Antarctica film, because it is something else.
Did you see New Zealand and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I did. But only on a screener. I didn't see it during the festival itself.
But that's the other thing is.
But it was very television. It comes back to a discussion we were having earlier on. Is that I can't see it taking out that particular award, even though it was an important story and really well told, because it felt like television to me, and it's a cinema.
Of the three films, which one's had a theatrical release of any substance?
Yeah, Gardening. Hmm? Yeah, fair enough. But
it's another box.
There we go.
It's there already. If I was a gambling man.
Yeah, true. But I'm not. True. Look, I understood, but I do think that it says something about the strength of New Zealand documentary at the moment. That's so that the films that are so different could be contenders. Just on the subject of documentary, you may remember over a year ago we did an interview with the filmmakers from How Far Is Heaven, and that is just about to be released on home video, so if it hasn't already. So I said that we would mention that we did that interview and that we might post a link to that interview again for people who wanted to go back to it, because another tremendous New Zealand documentary and a chance to own it at home now.
Mm. So much goodness going on. Stateside, President Barack Obama visited Hollywood on Tuesday, giving a speech at DreamWorks Animation. However, there was dissent shown by many in the industry as dozens of former DreamWorks animators took to the streets to protest at the instability in an industry that has been hit by massive layoffs in recent months.
It was interesting, the backstory behind all of that, because there's a similar pressure in Hollywood as there is in the film industry all over the world to increase subsidies to try and sort of get support to local industries because of the jobs that are created. And a lot of the people that were marching today to raise awareness for this were people that had been laid off from jobs at DreamWorks Animation but then brought back as contractors. So, you know, on different terms and only on a project-by-project basis. And so it's really tough for a lot of people all over the world, whether you're in the effects business, the animation business, or the filmmaking business. And it just shows you that, you know, that pressure, that LA itself isn't immune from that sort of pressure.
Because that's how Weta Digital works, is they're all contractors.
Yep, that's right. And it's when times are good, times are great. But when they're not, there's not much sentiment in that business.
But that's just, you know, I think big picture-wise, it's because it's how people want to cut the cake. It's all about where you want to shift that profit or where you want to shift that capital and how much of it. It's just about being fair, isn't it? And you know, I mean, how much is somebody worth? Are they worth 10, 15 times more than the guy who's on the floor doing this and that? You know, probably not.
Well, it's an interesting discussion. Like I know that, for example, people who work on shows like Spartacus or what have you in Auckland in the past, those actors and technicians on those productions are being paid less now than the equivalent were being paid on Hercules and Xena. This is like in pure cash terms, right? They're being paid less per day than they were on Hercules and Xena back in 15 years ago. And But the studios are making roughly the same amount of money as they were. So in order to preserve studio profits, effectively, people actually working at the coalface are being paid less and less and less. And, you know, if you're an actor and you this is how you make your living, it now takes you 2 days to earn the same amount as it used to take 1 day. So I think that, yes, you know, relative worth of people's jobs and the fact that somebody is making a big punt on all of this, you know, there's no guarantee that films are going to sell. There's no guarantee that box office will work. Somebody's actually, you know, putting their hands in their pocket to try and make stuff happen at all. And you understand you want to reward risk takers, etc. But it seems like it's all out of whack. Really.
Well, you look at the model of where did Fordelheisen come from? That was Denmark or Norway or something like that, you know. And they've got a very vibrant industry. You know, they make great films, I mean, and they also make great TV, and yet it's heavily run by the state, you know, and it's, you know, there are different models to look at, not just one, and I wonder if, you know, that we should be looking, you know, maybe not the ones driven out of the US, but maybe some of the European models.
Well, I think you're right. I was at the Big Screen Symposium earlier on this year, where lots of independent filmmakers and film industry people got together, and we listened to a talk by Daniel Borgman, who made The Weight of Elephants, which was part funded by the Danish Film Institute, and he was saying that, you know, Denmark's got a population not a million miles away from New Zealand in terms of numbers, but it's got a thriving local television scene, and it's got the box office returns for local films are really strong, and they're really well supported. And apparently the amount of funding from the Danish Film Institute is something like 10 times as much as gets put into the New Zealand Film Commission, for example. And a lot of that money goes into education, and, you know, the Danish Film Institute is also the archive. And so that money gets spread around a few different projects, but a lot of it goes into producing stuff. Now, it helps that they can sell direct to a wider European market, so that audiences are easier to find. So there's different economics behind it, but they committed 20 years ago, they made a commitment that they would support local content and local culture, and now they're reaping the rewards of that. Instead of here in New Zealand, we're still having the argument.
And that's right. We haven't really evolved in any way.
No, I think that's absolutely
right. We'll
still
go from the peaks and the lows. You know,
yeah, and I think that there's still a good proportion of the New Zealand population that feels like they don't want their taxes spent on, you know, have jollies for film people, basically, you know, and it's a sign of a sort of immaturity of in terms of New Zealand character and New Zealand culture generally, that that argument is so hard to win. Anyway,
we could
do a whole show on this topic, yeah. But time to get
maybe
back.
We should.
Well, I think so. I know there are a lot of people who want to contribute to it, definitely. So maybe that's I shall diary that. I shall tangle that idea. It's time to talk about arguably the best of the three films that we're going to talk about today.
Who else knows about this?
Just me and Galen.
Good. This boat's ours.
Someone's here.
What?
Someone's living in our boat.
You know that guy?
I've never seen him before.
What'd you say, boys?
You got crosses in your heels.
Nails. Shaped like crosses.
What for?
Ward off evil spirits.
You never said your name.
Mud. You can call me Mud.
Right, it's a film by Jeff Nichols.
Trailer music is really intense.
Look, the trailer itself is not unintense, I have to say, and the film is pretty solidly intense as well. This is, I think, a really, really great example of the kind of films that are hard to get funded, hard to make, hard to get into cinemas, and hard to get audiences to, but really, really rewarding, right? Because it's a drama aimed at a sort of young adult audience. I think it's, you know, it's about two kids and a sort of coming of age story or a loss of innocence story for these two kids. And, you know, it's not a huge budget film. It doesn't have huge big name box office stars. It's not got much in the way of, I mean, there's no special effects. There's no fantasy element to it. It's about, you know, real people in a real part of the world. And it really does a fantastic job of burrowing into the psychology of what it's like to be a sort of kid roaming around on your own sort of recognizance, investigating and exploring the world around you, and then finding perhaps something that you shouldn't find. These two young kids, played by Ty Sheridan and Jacob Laughlin, they take a boat trip up the river. They're sort of living in the sort of the south, eh? In the
Everglades. Mississippi.
This is Huck Finn, isn't it? It's loosely kind of...
Yeah, it's very much inspired by that, I think. Mm. They're just sort of wandering pretty aimlessly in the school.
But only white people.
In the school, after school, and they take a boat trip to an island, and they go exploring, and they find there's a yacht sitting in the trees that's been washed up in one of the big storms, in a flood previously, and it's trapped in the trees, and they think this is a fantastic playhouse. And when they get inside, they realize that somebody's actually living there, and that person living there is an escaped convict. So a little bit of Great Expectations going on as well. An escaped convict named Mud, played by the brilliant Matthew McConaughey. And he sort of wins these kids' trust and asks for help getting the boat down from the trees and the boat off the island, and also to pass messages to his girlfriend, who's sitting waiting for him in a cheap motel on the other side of town. Meanwhile, the people who the family of the guy that he killed in order to go into prison in the first place know that he's escaped, and they're looking for him. So there's a ticking clock there as well, because eventually they're going to close in on him. And these two kids are caught in the middle of this great drama. And did you see a Jeff Nichols film called Take Shelter a couple of years ago?
No,
it was in the film festival. Yep. Well, I tell you what, it's brilliant, and Nichols, I think, is just a fantastic director. I remember coming out of Mud during the film festival, wishing that he was directing big commercial films and putting his eye and his taste and his ability with actors and his eye for detail and putting that on really big commercial films, because rather than some of the sort of crap that we're having to put up with, you know, the Ratners of this world. But at the moment, he seems to be sort of happily ensconced in this sort of mid-budget level, working with really good actors and writing his own scripts, and seems to be happy. But I tell you what, it's a film that I can't really praise highly enough, because, you know, it sets out to do a job and it does it really, really well. Now, I know that you're quite fond of this one as well, Simon.
Oh, only from the point of view that we're playing it. I wouldn't, and I know, you know, I think it's probably not right for me to chip in there and
feel free. I mean it's not like, I mean, you're playing a lot of films that we talk about on the
we're the only ones playing it though, so it's kind of, you know,
well
but I mean, look, it's a great film, and it deserved, you know, it was a hard one to convince the distributor to release. It took a lot of time and effort actually to pry it from their hands, and fortunately we were able to do so, it's satisfying to get these sorts of films, you know, actually released post-festival, and it's a bit of a worry that it seems to be getting increasingly harder to do so. These films should be played after, you know, they should be seen.
Yeah, and look, I think that there's a lot of names in this film that are worth keeping an eye out for. Certainly the two young kid actors, Ty Sheridan, Jacob Laughlin, worth keeping an eye out for those names. Reese Witherspoon, who's I've not really enjoyed in much of the choices that she's made in terms of her career recently. I think she's terrific in it. McConaughey is just going from strength to strength to strength. You've seen the Wolf of Wall Street trailer, which he steals completely, McConaughey. You know, it's mm-hmm. and it's kind of hard to steal a trailer off DiCaprio, I would have thought, but he does it. And I just think that it's fantastic watching this third act of Matthew McConaughey's career, as he's just like doing really, really interesting parts and playing them spectacularly well.
Yeah, because you've got Dallas Buyers Club too, which he's in.
I know. And
he's doing some really interesting things, isn't he?
He's decided that, you know, his days as a leading man are over, and he's just going to go where the interesting parts are. He's going to be a character actor again, which is where he started, and I'm thrilled about it, to be honest. It's fantastic. Mud, it's only playing in at very limited locations, right? So, as you know, just here at Lighthouse in Wellington and in Auckland, where is it playing? Is it
at the Lido?
At the Lido, right?
Or the capital, the Lido, yeah.
One of those two.
Yeah.
And they're close enough that you can run. You can run between them if you go to the wrong one.
That's right.
But not any further. No further out than that at this point. So if you're in Auckland or Wellington, you'll get a chance to see it on the big screen, and do seek it out, because I reckon it's the of the three films that we're talking about today, it's the one that's the easiest for me to recommend to people. Two words.
Oh, you go. You give your two words.
Okay, I'll do my two words for it, and that is Lost Innocence. Yeah.
My two words are Mississippi Blues.
You've seen it.
I told you. I emailed you and told you I'd seen it.
I got confused with Filth, which is why I asked you about Filth. Well, then, why don't you not just...
Do we have enough time?
Yes, we do. Yes,
I feel like it's been a really long episode.
Because it's not been exciting enough?
No, it's just been long. It's just felt really long.
Give us a couple of minutes of what you thought.
I really enjoy films, the sort of independent films from America. I think that there is a lot to be said about their independent film market that they have. There's a lot of really incredible stories that are coming out, and a lot of stories that have been coming out of sort of the Deep South, which are just fantastic, and sort of this, especially involving kids. Like, we had Beasts of the Southern Wild, and now we have this to sort of add to that similar canon. Oh, sorry, I'm getting chest cramps. I liked it so much, I'm in pain.
Do we need to pause and call an ambulance?
I really enjoyed it, and I highly recommend it. So, very good
stuff. And your two words, which I spoke all the way over.
Yeah, my two words for Mud are Mississippi Blues.
Well done. Yeah, good stuff. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week on the show, let's just have a look at the calendar. What have we got next week? We've
20 feet.
The Delivery Man, 20 feet from Stardom.
Yes, Delivery Man.
Yeah. So, yeah, actually, it's going to be kind of interesting.
There's a bit going on.
Mr. Morgan's Last Love, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's starting to heat up as we get close to Christmas.
Definitely. I'm excited to take on Delivery Man.
Yeah, we're going to give you that one.
Did you see the French-Canadian one?
I loved Starbucks. Mm. I loved it. Yeah, so I'm just going to, I don't know.
And apparently, this is not the first remake. There is a French version as well, I read today. A French version, which somebody may have been pulling my leg, but I will delve into that.
I wouldn't be surprised. They'd be like, we do not understand this Canadian film.
That's right. It's got French.
So all of that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software, so the latest episode always gets downloaded automatically as if by magic. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store, those ratings, those reviews, they're super useful to help people discover the show. You can contact us via various social media forms, including snail mail. We get occasional postcards.
Yes, we do. Mm. Occasionally, we do. Which you can tweet us if you'd like to know our snail mail address. You can find us on Twitter, of course, at CinematicaCast, which is our Twitter handle. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can read our two-word reviews, and as always on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
And skywriting, of course. Two-word reviews, perfect for skywriting. So get into it, people, for in time.
That's right. That's the newest thing. Yeah. I hear it's worth $1 billion on the US market.
Yeah. What, like writing with an airplane?
Yeah.
Skywriting.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be able to see it through our skylight.
You could...
Or you could just make guess the words in clouds. That's worth a lot of money, too.
You can put it in icing on a cake and then take a picture and tweet it to us.
Or send us the cake.
Yeah,
that would I would prefer that option personally. Okay, the show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music. None of the pop tunes from the Hunger Games soundtrack album actually appear in the film, so I've ignored that. So this week I thought I'd play you a little bit of the weirdest cameo of the week. This is David Soul, Silver Lady, originally from 1977, and it's now including David Soul himself in Irvin Welsh's film. Well, it's not Irvin Welsh's film, but Irvin Welsh's Filth. Until next week, that is all from me.
And all from me.
And I.